Bomb Chick. We're listening to the Quarter to Three Movie Podcast, starring the vocal stylings of Kelly Wand.
La 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 la.
Well done. We will be spoiling Toy Story 3 this week. And for this spoiler-ridden podcast, Kelly Wand, do you have a tagline?
Yeah. If you want a friend, you don't buy a friend, Eric. You earn a friend through love and trust and respect. That's from the first Pixar movie, The Toy, with Richard Pryor, precursor.
I'm also joined by Dingus Maslansky, I believe. I think that's right. Is that a Czech name? Dingus Maslansky, ladies and gentlemen.
I believe it's pronounced Yidney.
Ah. Don't know what. Okay, I'm writing that down to see what it spells backwards. Oh, very good. I just got that. That's a joke from Toy Story. You'd think I would have remembered.
Thanks, James Cameron.
Kelly Wand, because there's a lot of plot stuff going on.
I heard that.
Why don't you tell us what happens in Toy Story 3?
Oh, dude, Toy Story 3. Where to begin, man? So much plot to go over. Okay, so Andy, that dude. The kid is going to college to learn computer animation, but his mom wants to throw away all his toys or donate them to daycare or the attic, where she'll throw them away in a few weeks when she cleans the attic out. But he takes Woody to college with him. Wait, he wants to take Woody to college with him? Because he wants to have this toy cowboy in his dorm room for his dorm mates to vomit all over whenever they get drunk. But the trash bags get switched because the little sister's too old for Barbie. So Woody gets them all to daycare, but it's run by an evil pink bear. But they get put in the slow kids' room and comically mangled. But Woody wants to go to college with Andy, so he hang glides out. But he winds up at this girl Bonnie's house, where he learns the bear's evil, so he goes back to bust them out, and they all almost die a bunch of times. But it all works out. At least until Bonnie hits puberty. Toy Story 4.
Very good. All right. Who saw it in 3D, by the way? Go ahead. It's hard to what?
And it's hard to summarize a Pixar plot line.
Amazing. I thought you did a good job. It sounded, Kelly Wand, like... It sounded like you were reluctant to poke too much fun at it. Is that correct?
Well, I didn't want to spoil it. Actually, whenever I feel, you know, if it's spoilable and people are going to see it, then I don't want to ruin it. You might hear this.
Well, now hopefully...
Spoiler, do you mean whenever you feel for the film you don't want to spoil it?
Yeah. Right. Or unless it's good to spoil it.
Well, we are, if you were listening, and this is sort of the conceit of our podcast, if you're still listening after I've announced the movie, we will spoil things for you. So, Kelly Wand, always feel free to spoil things.
Even though you haven't made that announcement until now?
No, he said at the beginning, we'll be spoiling Toy Story 3. You're covered.
All right.
So, Kelly Wand, anything you want to say about the movie, you are covered. You are safe. Just so you know.
Okay.
So then what I'm wondering, what I'm sort of getting at then is it seems like you didn't want to make fun of the movie too much because you loved it. Am I right?
It's pretty good. But isn't it kind of the same thing as the second one? Like, isn't that the same plot line where there's abandonment issues and the benign toy turns out to be evil and then they just have to break out of somewhere?
Dingus, why did you field that question? Dingus, field that. I'm curious what your take is on that.
There are a lot of similarities, you're right.
You saw all three movies this week with your kid, correct? Wasn't that supposed to be like his first movie in the theater?
I saw number two with him, and then we went to see number three together.
You skipped one?
We saw number one quite a while ago. And I threw number one on just a little bit ago just to get a sense for what the differences are. But I haven't seen number one in a few months. But we saw number one a few months ago, and then we saw number two on Thursday, and we saw number three on Saturday. Sure. So one of the stark things that is very similar about two and three is the use of a deprogrammed or original Buzz. So that is something that's definitely the same.
But this time he's Spanish.
Did either of you see that as necessarily a weakness? The similarities, various similarities between the two, between two and three?
No, because it's just what happens in the story. That's all you can do with the toys. They have to constantly break out and avoid the trash compactor. That's what their lives are like. But also, the message of this movie seemed to be, don't give your toys to the daycare center because the Mongoloid kids will break them.
Mongoloid kids. I don't, because I see sort of an arc going on over the three movies. I mean, do you have the same problem Kelly has?
I think I'm going to end up being an odd man out here because I didn't care for it. I thought it was fine as a little adventure movie, but I thought it was more Toy Story 1.5. My biggest problem with Toy Story 3 is Toy Story 2. I thought it was a pretty weak follow-up to Toy Story 2.
Toy Story 2 is the perfect movie, wasn't it? Like they did some test of like what audiences like in movies, and Toy Story 2 like hit was like statistically the most perfect movie ever made.
Ah.
Audience reaction.
Well, as I've said else at other points on this podcast, I do think it is one of those rare perfect movies. I mean, Toy Story 2 would be a tough act for anything to follow, but I was particularly disappointed with how Toy Story 3 did that. And Dingus, I would be curious. So you do see them as a continuous arc. Like, you do see Toy Story 3 as an effective continuation of 2?
Well, certainly, mainly because of where Andy is going. I mean, the character of Andy, if you look at all three movies, you see Andy growing. And you see sort of a return to him at the beginning of the movie. The movies are very different in a number of ways, but I think looking at the way at where Andy is going, just age wise, I mean, obviously there's a continuation as far as his character is concerned. Mm-hmm.
But I think regardless of Andy, it seems like 3 is playing on the same sort of dramatic tension as 2, namely what happens when your owner loses interest in you, and we already saw that in 2, and we already saw that explored, I thought, as a very heartfelt sort of metaphor for death in a way. If I wanted to get like real pretentious, I could say a metaphor for the existential dilemma. Like 2 really explored that very well, I thought. So when 3 opens up with basically the same premise, oh no, Andy's lost interest in us, I'm like, you know what? I already saw, you know, the fallout of that with how Jessie was introduced in Toy Story 2 with her story about Emily. Like that was a central part of Toy Story 2. So when they introduced that as the starting point for Toy Story 3, I was expecting, well, okay, this is a jumping off point. They'll do some new kind of different things. And I didn't feel like it really added anything to what we'd seen in 2.
This Bond movie opening wasn't as awesome as the Toy Story 2 Bond movie opening either.
And I want to talk about that, but for a different reason in a little bit. But so Dingus, go ahead.
Sorry.
Well, I definitely see what you're talking about as far as Emily is concerned, or the Emily story is concerned, in 2. But what I think is interesting about 3 is that you see the dark side of that in 3 with Lotso. So you have the Emily thing going on in 2 and how Jesse is introduced, and then you see how that turns dark as far as Lotso is concerned when he and the baby and Chuckles are abandoned or accidentally. But you know, Toy Story 2 isn't, unless I'm really missing the point, isn't really about him losing interest. It's about damage and repair. I mean, Andy Andy isn't, but Andy isn't losing interest in Woody in Toy Story 2.
Well, hold on. So Toy Story 2 is more about the toys than Andy, and it's about the toys' fear of, you know, Woody has the nightmare scene in Toy Story 2 where Andy has lost interest in him. So it's about the fact that the toys are aware that their children are going to grow up and lose interest in them. And that's not actually what happens. Now, it then does happen in the beginning of Toy Story 3, but all that leads into is from my perspective, just another adventure, which would have been fine following up Toy Story 1. But the reality of that is constantly present in Toy Story 2. And I think the resolution of Toy Story 2 is that you accept that. Toy Story 2 is almost this, I don't know how I would characterize it, but the resolution of Toy Story 2 is, yes, Andy's going to lose interest in you, but that's just the way it works, and you don't want to miss it. As a matter of fact, I even wrote down, because I just finished watching Toy Story 2, because I wanted to remind myself of some of it, the sort of the resolution of Toy Story 2 is Woody saying, of course I can't stop Andy from growing up, but I wouldn't miss it for the world.
Right. Mm.
So Andy's grown up in Toy Story 3, and it's something that we already know Woody is aware of, and he's sort of reconciled himself to. So it's sort of like, you know, that issue got sort of resolved, and Toy Story 2 addressed that very well, I thought.
Well, Toy Story 2 is addressing that that in the way of, I'm making a proclamation for the future. I will be with you forever. I will be your friend forever. I will be together through thick and thin. And Toy Story 3 is testing that as it actually happens.
Okay.
So Toy Story 2, you're right, is we're afraid this is going to happen in the future. Andy hasn't really lost interest, but they're afraid of that. And you're right about that nightmare sequence. But Toy Story 3, is that actually coming to fruition?
Yeah.
And how do we actually deal with the reality of it as
good.
Opposed to the fear of it?
So then let's talk about that. Go ahead, Kelly Wand.
I was going to say, all their worst nightmares about what their final fates can be in Toy Story 2 are lived out in Toy Story 3.
Well, let's talk. Okay, so moving on then, in Toy Story 3, then explain to me what is the well, let me put it this way. We learn a lot of new things about the characters in Toy Story 2. What new things do we learn about the characters, or do they do in Toy Story 3? Kelly Wand, you mentioned they live through all of their worst nightmares. Can you elaborate on that?
We learn that there's such a thing as being played with that's not fun. Which, mm-hmm. in the first two movies, they get slammed around a lot, but they like it.
Mm-hmm.
But in Toy Story 3, we learn there's a threshold for pain on toys, which to me
you
is pretty
see that with
pretty
a neighbor boy.
And we also learn that Mrs. Potato Head can see with her eye, like the witches in Clash of the Titans, like across town, which is pretty awesome. And I liked a lot of those little touches in Toy Story 3, and that's why I think I like the movie more than you. There's like a lot of hell imagery in it.
Besides the incinerator, prisoner?
The monkey and the sounds the monkey makes, the evil monkey, and the baby
right.
is like this golem, this gigantic golem that like
right.
lurches
right.
around. I love that. I loved how traumatizing it was. And I think if I'd been 5, this movie would have freaked the hell out of me. I think it's nightmarish. It's like a horror movie. That's what drew me to it. And that's why I'm surprised you didn't like it more, was because it's a horrifying film.
I did like some of those touches. I liked how scary the monkey was, and I liked the creepy baby. But as far as where they fit into this sort of dramatic structure, like what do they tell us about the metaphor? What do we learn about Buzz and Woody, about the core characters?
Speak Spanish.
But I didn't think they were there. You're talking about the Mrs. Potato Head eye and the pain threshold. Those were like these weird little plot points that they put together to create a story. But I didn't feel they were as meaningful as doing things like meeting Jessie or hearing about her backstory or the little claw aliens. You know, the claw aliens in this were this convenient Deus Ex Machina.
Which was
a chilling, effective scene, and I felt like these little claw aliens were this punchline to conveniently get them out of it.
Yeah.
You know, what drives things in Toy Story 2 are the decisions the characters make.
Mm-hmm.
What drives Toy Story 3 are little plot elements like a hang glider, like the eye being able to see across town, and like the aliens jumping into the claw. And that's fine for an adventure movie. I'm fine with that. When you follow up on Toy Story 2, which is driven by characters' decisions, you know, am I going to go with Andy or am I going to go to a Japanese museum for collectors? You know, that's what drives Toy Story 2, and that's, to me, what makes it a better movie. They what? Go ahead.
They decide to die together, and even though they rescued the bear.
You know, they didn't decide, though. I loved that scene, but that scene, to me, was they resigned themselves to die.
Right.
They all looked at each other, and they knew they were going to die, and that was an incredibly effective scene.
Yeah.
To know, but it did nothing except to show us how they're going to behave on the threshold of death.
You know what they're I thought the Deus Ex...
And I don't know why we needed to see that.
I thought the Deus Ex Machina was going to be Andy shows up and uses the points. And I was like, no, he doesn't think they're junk. And I don't know how that would have worked, how he would have known to be there then. But you're right. And also, Tom's point, too, like the ending of Toy Story 2, I remember being much more satisfying than the idea of them going to live with another kid where they'll soon have these exact same problems in a couple of years. Sorry, Dingus.
No, that's okay. That's okay. I think Tom makes a really good point about that scene, because that scene is gripping and almost embarrassingly so. Embarrassing is the wrong word, but I can't think of another word to use. The way the characters are looking at each other and taking each other's hands has almost, you know, almost, I really hate to say this, almost like a United 93 moment kind of a feel to it. Like,
sure, yeah.
they are resigning themselves to this fate, and this is it. And it is such a touching, poignant, and real moment. And for me, while I loved so many things about Toy Story 3, it deserves a better resolution than that Deus Ex claw. It just deserves something more. It is so real and powerful. The way those characters look at each other and take each other's hands, it's stunning, and it deserves something more. And I don't really know what to do with what you're saying about what it says about them, Tom, but I believe it deserves something more as far as a resolution is concerned.
And Pixar usually gives pretty good resolutions. They write themselves into a corner like that, and then they usually pull a rabbit out of the hat.
Do you guys know who wrote this script?
I saw the guy's name. I didn't recognize
his name is Michael Arndt, and this is his second full script. His first script was a movie that I think Dingus loves called Little Miss Sunshine.
Stop it.
But that to me, I did not know this until I was just writing down some notes and looking up things, because it was also it's a guy who's been with Pixar for a while, but the director, Lee Unkrich, this was his first project where he was the sole director. And this is the second script from Michael Arndt, the guy who did Little Miss Sunshine. And that to me speaks volumes.
Lee Unkrich and Andrew Stanton also work on the script?
Well, no. Yeah. I mean, the script is a collaborative piece, but it comes from... you know, it was actually Michael Arndt wrote it from a treatment that I think it was Stanton or Lasseter that one of the guys came up with. But he's responsible for, it looks like, the overall script and the structure of the plot. I mean, that shows to me. I did not care for Little Miss Sunshine at all. It was manipulative. It was schmaltzy. And there were touches of that here. Like, you know, Dingus, that incinerator scene was remarkably effective. And, you know, I loved it. And I tear up watching that kind of stuff. But it felt manipulative because it didn't go anywhere. And it was just there to give us a little bit of a tense moment. You know, it was this emotional cliffhanger that they had set up the resolution for, not, you know, 2 minutes beforehand by having the little claw aliens run off. And it just felt like this little emotional cul-de-sac that we were going to be sent down. It was effective but manipulative, I thought. And
what about that throwaway line where he talks about what about Bo Peep? Remember that line?
I don't remember that line, but that's another thing I wrote down, is what the heck happened to Bo Peep?
You never
find
out.
That. No, I love that line. And that, for me...
They don't even talk about it.
That moment is an example of Pixar getting the little touches without hammering them into your head. That moment is undescribably beautiful to me because they don't harp on it.
So what happened? Like, the idea was just she'd been given away?
Well, they don't go into it. They're, you know, it's at the very beginning when they're having to get rid of toys, and Woody's talking about we've lost toys along the way, and somebody says Bo Peep, and Woody just pauses and says, yeah, Bo Peep, and then he moves.
And that was his love interest too. wasn't it?
Well, yes.
Well, yeah, insofar as that is in that universe, yes. But they don't schmaltz it up, and they don't fall into a trap of she shows up at Sunnyside and they have this weird sort of reunion. Mm-hmm. It's just this reality of, yes, people pass from our lives and we eventually get over it. We pause, we catch our breath, and we move on. And I thought it was a lovely little moment.
What happened to the little rubber three-eyed aliens thinking that Mr. Potato Head was their, like, God and Savior and Father?
What do you mean?
Because that's how Toy Story 2 ended, is those little aliens revere Mr. Potato Head.
Well, you see them constantly do that, and then it turns around at the end.
Oh, they still were? Okay, that was another note.
When they rescue him, they go, yeah, we rescued Daddy Godhead or something.
Like that. Good. Okay, so that was there.
Yeah, cross that one off.
I did. I crossed that and the Bo Peep thing off. Good.
Well, I would like to talk about a couple of rules elements that I have questions about. Because heretofore, in watching the Toy Story movies, I really haven't questioned the rules of the Toy Story universe too much. But in this movie, I did have moments where I questioned the rules, and I need a little help with a couple of things.
Okay. I don't know that there's a consistent rule set, but go.
Tom doesn't like the movie, so he's not going to answer your question.
You know, that's
likes the universe, though. And
I like the universe, and I did like the movie. I just thought it was a
disappointing follow up to the perfect movie,
right?
Perfect middle movie. It was sure. The Jedi to the Empire Strikes Back, Toy Story 2.
I would go with that. Okay, I'm all right with that.
Ah, Tom called it Jedi.
All right, Dingus, what rules did you feel it broke rules?
Well, I don't know, and I'm curious because of what you just said. You don't think there's a consistent rule set? Are you saying that over the whole universe of these movies?
Well, I don't think there's anything like, you know, there are times that they could save themselves from peril if they would be more willing to be seen by human beings while they're moving and running around.
Well, that's my question. Is it a sense of willingness, or is it like Calvin and Hobbes, where that's one of my questions, where if an adult's even in the room, sometimes they can move and sometimes they can't. I'm not overly worried about that in the first two movies, and I am in this one.
Right. Well, in this one, in the second one, you know, they crawl all over. Was Wayne Knight the collector?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. They crawl all over that guy. An adult can be in the room and they can be right in front of the adult's face and still moving around. So, and you know, here they have the fake out where you think the janitor sees Woody and he's just like rubbing the spot off the mirror.
Right.
So I'm assuming because, you know, they drive a car. They drive a car and a baggage thing in Toy Story 2.
Right.
You know, that's how they get home I don't know the rules, but I think if they wanted to, they could get up and do a song and dance in front of Andy's mom. Throw that out there.
And then she wouldn't throw them away. She'd become famous like Richard Heaney.
But then they'd do research on them. That might be Toy Story 4 right there.
Don't say
it. What specific things were you thinking about, Dingus, like where the rules seemed weird?
Well, Kelly touched on one of them, and that's the Miss Potato Head eye,
right.
which my wife says happens before, but it seems to me it's always connected, like somebody's holding their eye out.
I remember being like Sauron's ring before,
right,
that tunnel.
And so that dovetails into Mr. Tortilla Head, which is very amusing, and everybody in the theater thought was very funny when I saw the movie, and I've seen it twice now. But for me, watching all of his parts, and this is going to sound incredibly pretentious, but I have to wonder where is the consciousness of Mr. Potato Head, because all of his parts can sort of gather and scurry around, and then his body is just this shell, and you can plug him into anything, and he can be Mr.
Yeah.
Potato Head.
Yeah, right. Brains in the tortilla.
And I don't understand where that is, and it bothered me the whole time, no matter how amusing it was. I don't think that works, and I don't recall feeling that way about the first two movies.
Right.
Hmm.
Let me tell you guys.
Brain,
go ahead.
His brain has to be in the empty plastic container for it to work, you're saying.
Well, there has to be some sort of sense from me, and I don't recall this from the first two films, that any part of his body can do whatever it wants. If that's the case, then just send all your body parts out to do different jobs. But again, this is part of me not remembering where the rules were set down as far as he's concerned.
Well, I actually think that's a valid concern, Dingus, in that, that's part of the problem with this movie, is that I don't think it does things just
arbitrary.
For the sake. It's arbitrary, and it does things for the sake of the gag or the plot point or the heartfelt moment of dire doom, like the incinerator. I mean, it's doing a bunch of stuff for arbitrary reasons that I don't think necessarily fits, and in a better movie, that wouldn't bother me.
Well, I agree with the Deus Ex Machina, but I would argue that the tortilla is more alive than the plastic. So if it's like it's made of natural ingredients, it's more organic.
Here's the rules bit that bothered me. You guys are familiar with electronics. You've dealt with computers and whatnot.
Where you're going. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, so when you hit the reset button on a toy, on an electronic object, you are essentially erasing its memory. You are resetting it. So when they reset Buzz, I was like, holy crap. And then I thought we'd lost him, and that's dark. With the monkey in the movie and the golem baby, I was like, wow, are they really going there? Are we going to have to rebuild? We know there's a bunch of Buzz Lightyears out there, and we know that he has this base sort of personality, but are we going to have to rebuild him? That's kind of huge. But they, later, and I don't even remember what precipitated it, he later snaps out of it. And that's not what happens when you reset an electronic toy. And I was reminded,
TV falls on him and he snaps out.
Yeah, that's right. He gets hit in the head, yeah. And I was reminded of the end of WALL-E, where WALL-E gets reset, but they go to great, they make it very clear that what restores him is a spark from Eva, is a kiss. This idea that love can transcend the idea of your simple wiring, that love exists somewhere else. And Eva restores it to WALL-E after he's been rebooted. Here, it's just, you drop a TV on his head, he'll be fine, he'll come back. That's a little rules bit that bothered me, where I felt, once again, the movie's just being arbitrary just for the sake of a gag. Let's have him be Spanish, and that didn't work for me.
Yeah, I think demo mode is a huge problem in this movie. And, I really loved this movie, and part of that is the situation in which I saw it. But I think you're absolutely right. And I brought this up, and I brought this up in discussing the movie with my wife, and I was shot down. She was fine with it. But for me, demo mode, first of all, he's owned the toy for, 10, 12 years.
She likes the brown meat. Happened.
And you switch demo mode on, and it restores him to factory settings. Forgetting for a moment, what role do batteries play in this world? he seems to be able to operate no matter what. So now we have batteries to deal with, and also when we go to the daycare center, they talk about there's so many batteries, you never have to worry about it. But he's been reset. And then a TV falls on him. And even my 5-year-old today, when we were talking about the movie, brought that up. He's like, so a TV falls on him? So even for him, when we're talking about the demo mode and Spanish mode, he goes back to English when a TV falls on him. My 5-year-old is having trouble processing why that happens.
Him in the meeting.
So I think even for him, that rings a little bit false. But for me, it's a big problem.
I like that your 5-year-old is totally picking holes in Toy Story 3. That's pretty good. He's going to be a smart kid.
You guys talk a little bit about, because I'm the nattering nabob of negativity here. You guys talk a bit about what's awesome in this movie.
Wait, was Dingus, did Dingus have more issues?
Other rules issues, Dingus?
Because I'm liking these so far. I'm trying to find ways, I'm trying to find sneaky answers to them to justify my not caring.
Well, my three main problems were the ones I'd already brought up, what is the rule as far as toy consciousness is concerned? How can toys be animated when they're around people? When you watch the first movie, what's really stunning when you put the first movie in is how much of a cartoon it looks like, and as opposed to how much of a movie this movie looks like. And the opening sequence of Toy Story 1 is very homemade as far as the playtime is concerned. Andy is playing with the toys. You see his arm in all of the shots. Woody is not animated. He's drawn all these boxes. He's running around throwing Woody in the air. And it's not until he absolutely leaves the room that Woody even moves. So it's very clear, whereas the other two, they find ways to make these grandiose computer-generated intro sequences that are very exciting and beautiful. You know, the in Toy Story 2, it's a video. It's that T-Rex is playing a video game, and in Toy Story 3, the idea is just, I guess, imagination, because it winds up being a home video. But it's this gorgeously shot, you know, train sequence with the train bridge blowing up and the attack of the Death Monkeys, and it's gorgeous, but it doesn't really follow as far as the conceit of the first movie is concerned.
Or the first two, I would say, because I think it's clear that the gag in Toy Story 2 is that it's a video game. It's not a child's imagination. A child's imagination doesn't need the sort of the graphics and the animation. The child's imagination just needs the toy and whatever props he's created. And I love that facet of Toy Story 1 and 2, because in 2 there are scenes where he's playing with the toys and they're not replaced by this lush CG sequence like in the opening of 2. And the gag there is, hey, it was just a video game. So I did not care for that at all in Toy Story 3.
Yeah, and you're right. It's gorgeous looking. You know, watching it again, it's jaw dropping to see the explosions and to see the mushroom cloud of the Death Monkeys, but it doesn't. It rings hollow when you realize, oh, they're not going to bother to justify it. They just, it's very clear that they just said, we felt like doing this and we're just going to do it and screw you if you don't like it. And whereas the first movie doesn't have that luxury. And I like that. But this sort of plays into what is the rule as far as what these toys can do, because in the second movie, Woody's like riding the side of the dog and he's around the people, and then in this movie he's climbing, like Tom said, up the wall of the bathroom, and maybe the guy sees him and oh, he doesn't, it's just a smudge in the mirror. What is the rule as far as what toys can do? And until you said earlier a moment ago, Tom, that in your opinion, if Woody wanted to, he could just do a dance in front of the mom. Why don't they? I mean, what is the code? Is the code ever set down why toys can't do that?
Yeah, I don't think it is, and I didn't. It never bothered me in the first two, but
right
here,
right.
Yeah.
So in answer to your query, Kelly, it's the Mr. Potato Head, everything about him and his wife, and then the batteries or demo mode thing, the batteries demo and Spanish mode, which at the end. At the very end, with the little joke with the boombox that Jesse does, you see that there's really no rules as far as Spanish mode is concerned. It's just a part of his being. You know, he's going to be sexier when he speaks Spanish, and they can play music for him, and he's going to dance in a sexy way and not have inhibitions like we have as non-Spanish people. But where does this come from? Who knows?
Right. He's still a boy child's action figure, but now he's a Lothario Puss in Boots.
So those are the three things that concern me, and I don't recall being worried about those in the first two movies.
That's only two, though.
That's okay. 2.5. How about that?
Also, the Toy Story 2 awesome opening, kind of like that was like the first time we'd seen an awesome Toy Story opening, and in this one, we're kind of like it's like the same thing,
right? But again, I want to stress the joke in the Toy Story 2 opening is that it's a video game and it's not the toys. It's not how Andy perceives his toys. The joke is it's how these toys are incorporated into a popular video game, and T-Rex is playing it, and there's the gags later about the strategy guide. But that's the whole joke, is that lush CG environment is not part of a child's imagination.
Yeah, and also he's doing like platformer stuff.
Right, exactly. And this is like, you know, this is like a car chase. I mean, the train, you know, the train and the horse, and you know, it's an action sequence, and it's straight out of some elaborately animated CG movie. That is, in fact, what it is. And now this is what we see on the inside of Andy's head, and I didn't like that at all.
Yeah, and he had the pig as the villain.
I think the pig's been the villain before, though. Like,
really?
I think that, I want to talk too about villains in Toy Story, because that was another thing that kind of bothered me. But yeah, I think the pig plays the bad guy.
He's
know.
He seems like an unthreatening villain, though. I mean, he can't move well, and he's the most fragile toy. He's like he exists to be cracked open, so you can get the quarters and stuff.
Well, he does have a hole in his tummy. You don't have to break him to get your money out.
Let me just tell you that kids don't really play fair as far as setting up fill-ins against their other toys. From personal experience, I see this. You know, you may have a massive army arrayed against a tiny little frog. They don't care.
Yeah, but the frog would be the hero because you go, oh, he's the underdog, the underfrog.
No. That's not how it works. That frog will get crushed.
Really? Kids like more is better, force, fascism. Ugh, I hate
it. No, there's a great deal of fluidity because, you know, next time around, maybe the frog will win, maybe not. But I can totally see Mr. Ham or whatever, Mr. Evil Dr. Porkchop, being the evil guy and getting to play that role. And in the first one, actually, Mr. Potato Head is the bad guy holding up the bank or something. And Woody has to stop him.
They take turns.
All right, what's your villain thing? Ken?
Oh, well, yeah. So villains in the Toy Story movies, specifically in Toy Story 2, the villain you discover is Stinky Pete, the prospector toy. And his motivation is he's just upset that nobody ever bought him. You know, he was the least appreciated toy in Woody's Roundup. Everybody loved Woody and Bullseye and Jesse, but nobody bought Stinky Pete. So he was mad that he never got played with, and now he wanted his chance to go to this museum in Japan and be adored by children. And so he ends up being the bad guy. He foils Woody's escape attempt, and he's going to make sure that they all get carried to Japan. The other villain is a human being, and that's kind of... That's different. I mean, the human world is different, so you can have villains there. But the comeuppance they get in Toy Story 2, the human villain, he just doesn't get the money he would have made to sell them. But the comeuppance for Stinky Pete is he gets thrown into a backpack that a little girl is going to pick up at the airport, and she sticks him in with her Barbie, and the Barbie says, "We're going to get a makeover." So, and he gets carted off. To have his face made up with face paint, to basically be played with by a little girl. That's his comeuppance. You know, Zurg, who briefly makes an appearance, the evil robot in the Buzz Lightyear universe, Zurg makes an appearance, and then his comeuppance isn't a comeuppance at all. He admits that he's Buzz Lightyear's father, the great Empire Strikes Back joke, and he ends up literally playing ball with the basic Buzz Lightyear model. So villains aren't... You know, villains have their own sort of reconciliation. They don't get sent to hell necessarily. And what happens to the poor bear, to Lotso, the bear in Toy Story 3, just felt really vindictive and petty. I thought that was it was a pretty mean thing to do, to have him strapped onto the grill of a semi, forever doomed to be splattered with bugs.
But he was a bigger dick than Stinky Pete, yeah.
He's the Emperor. I mean, that's his. You see the Emperor moment in this one rather than the Darth Vader moment.
And the Golem was
when
Vader.
He's thrown into the dumpster by the baby. Okay. That's very much the Emperor.
Yeah, oh, absolutely, right. But now let's. What brought him to that point? What made him evil?
He was mad. He was mad out of proportion to what happened.
Exactly. He felt like he'd been replaced. He had his heart broken. And this is what happens. So he goes wrong. He does bad things. But this is what happens to him. He gets a pretty horrifying punishment. Now, I would submit to you that Lotso and Jesse go through the same thing and get very different situations. Jesse's montage about Emily ends with...
But Jesse doesn't become embittered and evil.
Jesse does.
She becomes embittered, but she has somebody who can help her through that.
Right, Jesse.
She's also kind of a dim bulb, too.
Jesse definitely stops Woody from escaping. You know, Jesse obstructs Woody's return, and she's going to make sure that they all go to the Japanese museum for collectible toys. She is embittered. I mean, she's very sad. You know, you're right. She's not as aggressive and authoritarian as Lotso, but her little story about her and Emily is almost the same. And this is another thing where I'm like, couldn't we get something different? The same as Lotso's story about he gets left behind Lotso on accident, and she gets a new Lotso and loves that one instead. Jessie, the girl, grows up and puts her in a box and donates her and gets rid of her.
But in the third movie, they all get abandoned except Woody, and they don't become power mad like Lotso. They just go, well, fuck Andy, but here we are at the daycare center.
Well, they, I mean, they, right, they sort of briefly think we'll live in this new sort of paradise.
Here I'm using the F word on a Toy Story podcast.
but my point is that 2 was so delicate about why is someone a villain and what happens to that.
Yeah. You know, it was all character. They all got out of it based on character, right?
Based on character, and it does teach, I think of a child watching Toy Story 2, there's no vindictiveness to it. It's done in a very sort of loving, caring, understanding spirit. And this stuff with Lotso, I mean, yeah, Lotso is an authoritarian jerk. He was the warden of this prison in this odd twist. But, you know, I thought he ended up with a pretty horrifying fate, and I'm not sure that, you know, it didn't handle villains with the nuance that I thought the second one did.
Hmm.
Angus, where do you fall on that?
I feel pretty uncomfortable about what happens to him, but the shock to me in seeing Toy Story 2 and then Toy Story 3 back to back is I hadn't seen Toy Story 2 for many years, and people constantly say how dark Toy Story 2 is, and that was not my experience watching it again, especially watching Toy Story 3, which goes very, very dark. And I'm thinking in particular, as far as Lotso is concerned, going into the incinerator and being saved and then turning his back and stabbing them in the back again.
Right,
And then what eventually happens to him.
He deserves hell. He's worse than Stinky Pete.
But his...
Stinky Pete's not a murderer, man.
His level of evil doesn't seem to be justified. And I just, right. I don't understand why he is so evil. There's a number of transitions in this movie that I have difficulty with. And keep in mind that I really did like Toy Story 3 quite a bit. But I feel uncomfortable, too, with what happens to him. And with a lot of that sort of in those incinerator moments where while I liked what they were going for, they were hard to watch.
And that's why I liked this movie.
Being so evil.
Right. I liked this movie because it went there. It was like, oh, I'm feeling uncomfortable watching a Pixar. I like that. You don't get that with other – you can get that with Shrek, which I saw this weekend isn't as bad as I thought it was going to be. Spoiler alert. It has a different villain comeuppance maybe you guys feel more comfortable with.
Don't spoil it for us.
Now, There are a number of light touches that I really did like in Toy Story 3, and a number of things that Pixar just can't help but get right.
Like Barney.
What's Barney?
Barney.
Barney, the chick. I thought she was adorable. That was my favorite.
She was wonderful. She was
Barney.
Wonderful.
Bonnie.
Bonnie. Little girl that
he Bonnie.
Right. She's lovely and the way she plays with her toys is lovely as well. She's a lovely little character.
So would you give a girl the same toys as a boy and she'd play with them the same? Like, will they get the same treatment that they want? Like, Andy gave them adventures, even though their adventures without Andy are kind of more intense than his stuff.
Oh, she surely will. I mean, she talks about, what are the ghosts throwing pies at the end? I mean,
ah, that's right.
Yeah, that's true. That's pretty good. I guess she's good. You're right.
And her little cast of characters has a wonderful little, you know, we do a lot of improv here.
Yeah.
That whole thing with Jeff Garlin in particular, knowing, you know, how Curb Your Enthusiasm is shot, that whole we do a lot of improv here, I thought was really clever. And are you classically trained in those types?
Who is that? Dingus? Jeff Garlin?
Jeff Garlin. He's a comedian who works on Curb Your Enthusiasm and produces it.
Just the fat guy.
Was he the snooty theater hedgehog?
No, I'm sorry. He was Buttercup. He was the horse who, okay. You know, the hedgehog who's Mr. Pricklepants was actually Timothy Dalton, I think.
No, stop. Really?
I think he was, Mr. Pricklepants, the one who says, you know, are you classically trained?
Right.
That was Timothy Dalton.
That's awesome.
But Jeff Garlin is Buttercup, the pretty horse, with his voice going, yeah, we do a lot of improv here. You're going to do fine. You know, that kind of thing. I thought all of that stuff was lovely. And she was – Bonnie was just charming as heck. Go ahead, Tom.
Oh, it's just – it to me, I hate to keep being negative, so you guys have to keep talking about positive stuff. But it was telling to me that the most adorable, expressive new character was a human being. I mean, Bonnie, the way she was animated and her character, just how expressive she was when she was like talking to humans and playing. Oh my God, I just fell in love with that, and I wish some of the other new characters we were introduced to had been as strong as this human character. I mean, I think of, and some of the toys I thought were horrible and creepy. The clown toy and the way the phone toy talked, I thought was just really out of sorts and odd. But I loved Bonnie. Bonnie could do no wrong. That part.
What about Barbie and Ken?
Barbie was cute. I thought it was sort of odd that the Barbies in Toy Story 2 were, you know, mass-produced...
Stepford wives.
Basically, yeah. And the fact that we were supposed to feel for this one, which, I was fine with that. They were good gags.
They didn't do any, different versions of the same toy gags in this movie ever, did they? But in Toy Story 2, they dealt with that.
They dealt with that with the Barbies and with Buzz Lightyear, yeah.
Yeah. Which is a big deal, because you think you go to a daycare center, you find like the...
Oh, that's right. I did love, by the way, and I guess this is the fallout when, I think it's Ghibli Studios, Miyazaki's...
Yeah.
Studio, I loved seeing the Totoro in the background, who, quite appropriately, I was so worried they were going to make him talk. Totoros do not talk. I was so glad he just remained quiet and big and stoic in the background there. That was adorable, too.
Also, this was my least favorite... short before a Pixar movie, that day and night thing.
Seemed built for 3D.
Me too. And I saw both versions, 3D and non. And, again, to bring up my 5-year-old, a couple minutes into that short, seeing the 2D version, and he just turned to me and said, "When's the movie going to start?"
What you said on the podcast, that's awesome. Yeah.
Seriously, he might be on in a moment. What's the takeaway from that? That Vegas brings us together? I mean,
yeah.
What the hell is the takeaway from Night and Day other than the 3D? Because in 3D, it is pretty stunning, but again, it bores the hell out of you after a while. Wow, there's hot chicks, and then
yeah.
They're not anymore. Oh, Vegas. Vegas brings us together. What is that?
You're right. What are hot chicks doing at night?
Whoa. Not age appropriate, Kelly Wand.
I really like your point, Tom, about the most interesting character being a human character, because I'm thinking about how I just fell for Jessie in Toy Story 2.
Yeah.
She's introduced and she's so live. She's full of life, and she's got such emotion to her and such a fragile heart and so. But she's so strong and interesting and crazy. She's a great character. And here you get Barbie and Ken, and they spend so much time on those gags, and they're amusing to people who like Barbie and Ken. But there's not any depth there the way you have with Jessie.
Yeah.
And other than that, I can't think of anything else that really rang with me. I talked about little touches. I like little things like the elevator at Ken's house and how it had a little hitch in its step on its way down. And there's little things like that. And I kind of got hooked a little bit by the soldiers leaving at the beginning, telling you when it's time to bug out. And I'm like, oh, little social
callback.
I like that.
Oh, I didn't even think of that. Well done, Dingus.
Well, I was like, oh yeah, I like how you're not gonna really harp on it, but I know what you're going for there. I like that.
See, it's a rack because you forget their troops are there for a long time.
Thanks, David Greenger.
What about? Okay, I wanted to bring up two.
Smurf trailer.
I didn't see any trailers. So, do we want to talk about a Smurf trailer?
I just wanted to say it.
Oh, okay.
Oh, well, I'm glad you brought it up, Kelly, because that'll give me a chance to go ahead and say this. The Smurf trailer played before the 3D version of the film I saw, and the 3D in the Smurf trailer was completely borked, and somebody had to jump up and run out and get them to fix it. I think the guy sitting next to me was an employee, because he had to run out and get them to... It was just a mess. I wanted to punch the Smurfs anyway, but I just wanted to say on the record again, and I kind of... turned a little bit after seeing How to Train Your Dragon, which made me have faith in 3D again. But I have to say again, I don't need 3D. I do not want to wear 3D glasses anymore. These were like wearing like a brick on my face, and I hated it. And the 3D didn't add a thing to it, and it only muted the colors. And in fact, one of the things that one of the audience quotes from this was at the end, some guy behind me said, "This is the last time I'm going to pay to see 3D." And I said, "Yeah, you're right, buddy, because when I take my family to this in a couple of days, because I saw it in 3D to sort of preview it, because this is the first time my 5-year-old was going to be in a theater, and I couldn't help but preview it." I said, "I'm not bringing him to see this in 3D. The color, it looks, it's again like wearing sunglasses, and I just don't need it." You know, How to Train Your Dragon was phenomenal in 3D, but that film was made for 3D. And Avatar was phenomenal in 3D, too. But I just don't need it. I don't want to wear glasses to watch these movies, and I don't want to wear sunglasses when I'm sitting in a movie theater.
I wear glasses, and then if you're already wearing glasses, it's even lamer.
Right, exactly. And me too. I don't want to wear two pair of glasses. I don't want to be 8 eyes or 6 eyes. I don't know how to do the math. But this, what you brought up about Smurfed just sort of drove that home. I knew from the beginning when the preview started that this is going to be just like wearing a cast for the whole movie.
I think Smurfed is probably being made specifically for 3D. So
good. I'll see that when I see that dancing movie you guys love.
I will go to that. Step It Up 3D.
I will go to that like you can't believe.
The hair dances.
I want to mention the running time. Because I felt, well, Toy Story 2 is so well-paced. I mean, it escalates beautifully, and each set piece tops the one before it, and they all build on each other, and it's so well-paced. And I didn't feel that was necessarily the case with this one. There was a lot of back and forth, and for a little bit it's a prison movie, and I wasn't quite sure what to do with the pacing of this. But it occurred to me, I wanted to look at the running times. The Toy Story movies, the first one was 80 minutes. The second one was 92 minutes. This one was 103 minutes. They've been progressively getting 10 minutes longer. And I think I finally felt that in Toy Story 3. You guys with me on that or no?
Well, it's just montages.
Well, I think that's becoming more and more a problem with comedies, and with all movies, but with comedies in particular, that they're not editing out 20 minutes. 15, 20 minutes should be edited out of most comedies that are released. And I don't know what that's a function of, but when I found out this movie was, what did you say, 103 minutes?
103 minutes, yeah.
I thought it was, closer to 2 hours. But, yeah, when I think that they could have taken some air out of it, and they're not doing that now, and I don't know what that's about.
How long is it in 3D?
Good point.
It's an extra D.
I only saw the 2D.
You saw it in 3D, didn't you?
I saw it in 3D and didn't. I
Nerd alert.
Lost track of it after a while. Like the 3D did nothing for me, and I felt that was completely unnecessary. And I'm with you, Dingus. And for something like this too, that it, you know, muting the colors, that's a huge trade-off. You know, watching through dim glasses really does hurt. And if you're going to do a lovely, colorful movie like this, you better make it worth my while. And I didn't feel they did.
Did they in Avatar?
You know where I stand on that.
That's another Smurf movie, by the way.
Avatar, yeah. Mm-hmm. All right, so what were some of your favorite poo and fart jokes in Toy Story 3?
The green boogers coming out of Potato Head's butt.
What? Wow. Okay.
I loved the sheet of toilet paper.
Ah, yeah.
How about when Buzz Lightyear wakes up and becomes Buzz Lightyear again, and he's in the trash truck, and he says, "I hope that wasn't me." See? You get it? You get it? Or the, I think someone says something about there's Lincoln Logs out in the sandbox.
Oh, Lincoln Logs. Well, wait, if Woody is waterproof because he's plastic, if he falls in the toilet, isn't that like a better way out? Like faster?
1, 2, 3, not only you and me, got 180 degrees, and I'm caught in between, counting 1, 2, 3, Peter Pan, Mary, free, getting down with free the peak, everybody has
open. Is Woody waterproof?
He's plastic. Isn't plastic waterproof?
He's fabric and he's got cotton in him, and I think he'd get pretty screwed up if he fell in the water.
His face isn't cloth.
That's a good point.
No, but his body is.
So you could
alert.
Yeah. So. Let's do a 3x3. Speaking of falling in toilets.
Ah, sweet segue, dude.
This week's 3x3, I want three restroom scenes that aren't gross. And I should have appended. The idea is they're supposed to be great restroom scenes or good restroom scenes or the best restroom scenes.
Oh, wait, hold on.
I trust you guys.
That are gross?
That are not gross.
Oh. All right, hang on. I got to do something.
I picked three really lousy restroom scenes from TV shows. Is that wrong?
I should have said it from movies, right.
Oh, crap.
Let's see. So, Dingus, you are, or no, Kelly Wand,
no.
You're doing next week's 3x3. So you
I have
out.
A bunch of different bad ones to choose from. I'm going to make you choose.
No, you have
no?
to choose. That is your job, Kelly Wand. That's why we hired you for this podcast.
Oh. Hired? Oh, yeah. I get paid to do this?
You bet. It's all going into a fund for when you decide to go to college.
You can have my Barbie when I do. Spoiler
Actually,
alert.
Part of that BT escrow account is going to you, Kelly.
I want my life back. I'm at a yacht race, but I want my life back. Spoiler alert.
All right, Kelly, what is your number three restroom scene that isn't gross?
This is a little off topic. Can I just do one throwaway I was thinking about?
No! Save them for the end, because you get to name three, because part of the issue is you can't, like, preemptively say things that other people might pick. So
right.
Until we start talking about our also-rans, you can only name three, I'm afraid.
Okay, so after the credits, if you want to hear an Easter egg, it'll be something I thought of today about Superman, if you want to hear that.
Superman was my number two.
No. It's just a random Superman thought I had baked today.
Okay, you could throw that out now, I mean, if you want. Okay, or we can save it. It can be
Let's wait. It's so good. It's just worth waiting for.
Okay, so.
Oh, yeah, I never thought about that. Superman.
Can you not say my number two when we're talking about this list?
He changes in bathroom stalls, doesn't he? That's not what the thing is. But don't worry, I won't say it by accident. It's too good.
Okay, so stick around for wait for the music to end. Kelly Wand will have something to say at the end of the podcast, so everyone knows. By the way, in case people don't know that happens every week.
What?
That once the music, you sometimes it's been Dingus for me, but almost invariably, if you turn the podcast off before the music ends, you are missing things that Kelly Wand is saying. I just want to tell people.
It's good about like one time in 38. It's like the 37th week, so next week I'm going to have something really good. Half credits.
All right, Kelly Wand.
Yeah,
that's good. What is your number three
I'm going to do a line from it.
Okay.
If you guys don't get it from this line, you guys suck.
Okay.
Spoiler alert. Birdie Num Num.
Did you say Birdie Num Num?
Yeah.
Is it Birdie?
Oh, really?
What?
You guys are such Philistines. You guys are such minor Dickenses.
It's from the party.
Dingus,
come
Dingus.
On.
Yay, Dingus. Hooray for Dingus.
From
come
the
on,
party?
That's a great party. That's a great bathroom scene, isn't it?
Yeah, I'm
overselling
about
it.
No, I totally forgot that. That's great.
It's a great scene. It's right after the Birdie Num Num scene. And it's like it's toilet paper. Doesn't a painting fall in the toilet, too? Am I thinking of Caribbean enthusiasm? And he has to pee really bad is why he's there, and he's had to, like, this Peter Sellers movie. All right, that's my number three, The Party.
I don't think I've ever seen that.
It jumps the shark once the elephant turns up, like in the last 20 minutes, but the first hour of The Party is good.
Okay.
And the bathroom scene is actually the high point of the movie, probably.
Should you describe the bathroom scene? What makes it good?
No. It's too funny.
Okay.
I don't believe watches Blake Edwards movies.
Oh. Okay.
Well, I might make
Peter Sellers plays an Indian actor who blows up the set comically. And he's accidentally invited to the party at the director's house. And he just, like, it's him at this party being dumb, basically, wandering around.
You know what? I'm sold. It's not a Pink Panther thing, right?
No. It could be, but it's not.
Okay.
But there's a scene set in a bathroom that's, like, 10 minutes long. And for most of that 10 minutes, the toilet's flushing. Spoiler alert!
Now, is there anything, Tom, not that this matters, because gross is up to us. according to Tom last week. But is there anything that Tom would consider gross in that?
No, just pee. Off-screen pee, which Tom's fine with, based on the golden showers. I mean, wait, what? Oh, we're still recording? So anyway, Superman.
Oh man, you talking about pee suddenly makes me think of a bathroom movie I forgot. Oh, crap. Oh well.
The thing is, you have not done any of your lists, so you could change it. What's your number?
I have 1,000 runners up. This was such an easy topic. It's the easiest one we've done. I had so many bathrooms to think about.
I was surprised as I was thinking of them. I was surprised how many had to fall off the list. Yeah, this was tough. So what's your number 3, Dingus?
You guys are gonna scoop my number 1 because it's so obvious. Spoiler alert.
All right, my number 3. Here's my quote. Since Kelly gave you a quote, I'll do that. Though I never do that. Do you know what I hate? I hate those 40-year-old jackholes wearing ponytails. That ponytail doesn't make you look hip, young, or cool.
Oh, that sounds familiar. Do you know it, Kelly?
Rushmore.
Ah.
Empire Strikes Back. Wait, ponytail.
Yes, because there's so many
ponytails. Coyote Ugly, because she cuts off the ponytail. Bridget Moynihan?
No.
Hmm.
The ponytail in question here gets shot off by the guy saying this line.
Shoot him up.
What'd you say, Tom?
Shoot him up.
Shoot him up is the movie. Good job.
Thank you. That was almost one of my choices. Why don't you explain the scene?
All right. This is my second favorite 2007 gun that falls into water and has to be taken apart, and the
drone
drive movie
with a carrot in it.
And it is also one of two movies that utilizes a hand dryer in my list today. So what happens in this awesome scene, is that Clive Owen's Mr. Smith goes into a bathroom, and there's a gross moment where he drops the gun in the toilet, but over all the scene, it's not gross. The gun gets wet. He goes to the baby changing station and breaks down the gun, dries it off, puts it back together, and this shooter comes in to kill him. And he ends up using the hand dryer to make the guy drop his revolver and then cocks his own gun, dries off the bullets and the firing pin using the hand dryer, and then his gun becomes operable again. And I just love that bathroom scene. And then he scoops up a baby off the floor and runs out.
That is one of the early inklings I seem to recall in Shoot 'Em Up that, oh my God, this movie's going to be great.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
I don't like that movie.
Have you seen it?
Yeah.
All right.
I don't like movies with babies in them because they're always like a cop out because you know nothing's going to happen to the baby. So it's a false MacGuffin.
a MacGuffin.
It's a MacGuffin, yeah.
Oh, MacGuffin. All right.
Flucker.
Shoot 'Em Up almost made my listing because you're lucky.
But I do like Giamatti in it. And I like Clive. I don't know. It's kind of repetitive.
No, but the bathroom scene is a great bathroom scene.
Yeah. It's good. Because he doesn't heat the guy's gun hand with the dryer to make him drop his gun. That's good, too.
It's great use of a bathroom for an action sequence. Yeah. Definitely tops Witness.
Oh, you took my number 2.
You know, Witness
off the table.
Yeah, Witness, Close Encounters, and Bring It On taken off the table last week. So, all right, my number 3, and Dingus, I'm afraid I now know I'm going to scoop you. You're the one that blew it. This is referred to as the commode story, or, quote, an amusing anecdote about a drug deal. And it's a story within a story within a story.
It's
Tim Roth demonstrating that he's a great actor in a movie where he has to be a great actor. In Reservoir Dogs, in order to sell himself as a criminal, his handler basically tells him you have to come up with an anecdote to tell. And his anecdote is the famous scene where he walks into the bathroom during a drug deal, and there's the four sheriffs with the German Shepherd staring at him while he's holding a bag of weed. And it doesn't really happen. It's not a real thing. It's a story that he's been told to memorize to tell the criminals. But as he tells it, we see the story. And in the story, it's really good, intense. You know, he takes a leak, he washes his hands, and he uses the hand dryer in this great sequence where there's like a jet engine playing, you know, to stand there with drugs in front of a bunch of cops with a dog and to take your time to dry your hands under a blow dryer like that. That's like the epitome of cool. And I love that little sequence in Reservoir Dogs. So that's my number three, is the imaginary that never really happened, amusing anecdote about a drug deal with Tim Roth.
For some reason, I thought it was going to be Train Spotting, but I forgot the gross.
Train Spotting is pretty gross, yeah.
Yeah. But you said drugs, and I went, oh, it's Train Spotting.
Now, I'm assuming, Dingus, because you said two of yours involved hand dryers, I'm assuming that was one of them.
You assume incorrectly, actually, although I was very close on that because I like the way the hand dryer sounds like an airplane taking off.
Yeah.
But no, it's a different movie involving a hand dryer. Nice try, though.
Right, because I had it as my number two, but I moved it to my number three when you said that.
I was close
Nerdus
on it.
Alertus.
I was surprised because I associate that with grossness. Because when his handler is giving him directions, he's like, you have to think about everything.
Right.
And one of the things he says is somebody sprayed all over the bowl, you know, diarrhea all over the bowl, which makes me think of that scene in a gross way.
But that, and the beauty of it, Dingus, is that's not, you know, you of course don't see that. That's right. The handler explaining that you have to vividly picture the bathroom that you're in. And when he actually pictures it, it's a pretty clean, pristine bathroom. He doesn't go for that angle.
Right, you're absolutely right. But my mental association is that description.
Right.
So, yeah, and you're right about how great, one of the things I love about it is that it isn't really happening.
Yeah.
Did Tom just start a sentence with the beauty of diarrhea? Or am I really baked right now?
I can't tell. We'll check the tape on that later.
Spoiler alert.
That's Meryl Streep and Alec Baldwin were in that film, right?
All right, Kelly, what is your number two? Remember, it can't be gross.
Okay, here's a quote from it.
Okay.
Totally, you'll not get the movie from. Which will make it really fun for listeners to listen to. Dad, look what I can do. I've been practicing. And then you hear like an armpit fart.
Zap?
No.
Wait, does this happen to you this week, or are you talking about a movie?
It happens to me every movie and every week. But it's not a comedy, so that's your hint. Give up?
I give up.
Citizen Kane.
This is actually my only good one. The other two are lame.
The party sounds good. Why are you down?
Oh, yeah, the party's good. Wait, that's my good one. This one's lame. That's what I meant. It's a little 2002 film starring Diane Lane and Richard Gere, my favorite on-screen couple, in Unfaithful.
Unfaithful. Wow.
Do you remember that scene? The bathroom scene in that where they take a bath together? And it's really uncomfortable, and she's, like, kind of dodging his touch because she's sleeping around already, and he's not sure if it's just him she's not into, but he can't tell what's going on, so it's, like, a lot of body language, like taking a bath with Diane Lane, but it sucks somehow.
My favorite sequence in that movie, it's a great character touch, is they're talking. He's in a room working at a desk or something, and she comes into the door, and they have a few lines with each other, and she's obviously, it's after she started having an affair, and she's talking to him, and they conclude the conversation, and as she walks away, she reaches in and flips the light switch off.
I love that part, yeah.
When he's still in the room, because she's just so unaware of his presence. I mean, it just so doesn't register for her. I love that character touch.
And also, it's like Richard Gere is a dude, I get the sense, has pretty good romantic life. So having him getting dissed the whole movie convincingly is kind of cool to watch. Like, yeah, whatever, Gere. Clap, the lights off. Boring. No bath with you tonight. Ugh. It's just Richard Gere. Ugh. I don't know. I like that movie. Although I think it jumps the shark a little towards the end.
Yeah, it has to do the whole murder kind
of
thing.
Yeah, that's not good. That's predictable.
Is that Adrian Lynn? Is that the...
Okay. Adrian Lynn. He makes a lot of bad movies, so we should have expected it to get lame, but the acting's so good in it that you go, oh, it's the story is going to be as good as this acting, because Diane Lane's so good, Gear's good. It's
like, now, was she nominated? She got a lot of recognition for that.
Yeah, she's really good at it. She has to do a lot of range.
Yep.
She has a lot of sex in it.
Well, and be the unsympathetic character, too. I mean,
She goes through a lot of mood swings, and then she meets him at the – she goes to the restaurant, and they have sex in the toilet. There's a bathroom sex scene, and then she comes back, and she's having lunch with her friends, and she pretends that she didn't just have sex in the bathroom. Do you remember that part?
I do.
It's got two bathroom scenes. Totally forgot about that. That's not gross either, isn't it?
Nope.
If you're the guy. All right, so my number two is Unfaithful, which has two awesome bathroom scenes, and my number one has three.
Whoa. Oh, okay. It has three awesome bathroom scenes?
Yeah, maybe I'll switch it out for the other one, then. All right, never mind.
All right. Well.
See, I still have time to remake the list. Until
you do, yes, you do.
Then I'm locked in.
That's right, you haven't said it yet. So, Dingus, you're on to your number two. You have to lock it in now. You ready?
I have to lock and load?
Yep. What do you got?
All right, here's my quote from my... Hold on, let me wait for Kelly to finish with his hand dryer.
No, I was nervous. I'm scared if I don't get the quote, nothing will happen.
All right, you're not going to get the quote. The quote is, it's working.
Howard the Duck? Wait, what's the other Jeffrey Jones? What's
there's
one with Sinbad?
There's no way you're going to get
the quote. Housecast!
The quote is, it's working, and I don't know if I remember many other quotes from this movie or any other quotes from this movie, because it's not an English language film. It's a Spanish language film. And it's working is in reference to the hand dryer that I talked about before.
Hmm. A Spanish language film with is it King of the Hill?
It is. It is El Rey de la Montaña.
Kelly Wand, you have not seen this, I bet, and you should.
No, I don't see movies that are in other languages.
Oh, well, here's
you
one.
You should
we
see this one. Yeah.
Or in English.
I love the way this. Well, I love the way this bathroom scene is shot, and this is one I've sort of been holding for. I just barely passed on it for the gas station list.
Oh.
I was holding it for another list as well.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a great scene, and it's very, very early in the film, so it's not too much of a spoiler for me to talk about it. But it's a guy stopping at a gas station, goes in.
Oh, my God, yeah.
He makes a phone call. He sees this amazingly hot woman in the, you know, that curved mirror they have up in the corner that's the shoplifting mirror. But the dude working the gas station is out filling his car up. But this guy talking on the phone, whose car is getting filled up, sees her shoplifting, and then she goes in the bathroom. And he goes in the bathroom, and she's in the bathroom in the stall next to him. And he's trying to be quiet, and he's very embarrassed, and it's very awkward. And there's this awesome overhead shot of the two of them doing their business, but it's not gross. It's her. She's changing. She's dealing with her bag, and he's getting ready to take a pee. And then it doesn't show any of this. And then he gets done, and he goes out to wash his hands, and she's already washing her hands. She's trying to use the hand dryer, and it's not working. So she's drying her hands with these paper towels and really being meticulous about it and checking him out as she does it. And then he tries to use the hand dryer and has to dry his hands. And she eventually sort of stops him, puts her body in front of him, and asks if he's going to report her. And then she just goes for him.
What do you mean, goes for him?
I mean, she bites his lip, or she grabs his lip with her lips, and they have sex right there on the sink. It's awesome.
Excuse me.
It's a freaking great scene. And this is almost number one. It was really difficult for me to choose which was one and which was number two. It's this great, it's a great little sex scene where you don't see it. She pulls up her shirt. They're there. And while they're having sex, the hand dryer just comes on and he says, it's working.
So this sounds like, Dingus, it's a sort of a madcap screwball romantic comedy.
It is, and Peter Sellers is in it. He shows up late in the game and throws a painting in the toilet.
Wait, so Mike Judge made that into a TV series?
the beauty, Kelly Wand, of King of the Hill is where it is that it does not do what you think it's going to do. And this is why I love seeing European movies, specifically like horror movies, is they don't have the same kinds of rules as American movies. And King of the Hill is a classic example of that. And if you can manage to go into King of the Hill knowing nothing more than what Intake has told you, you're in for a real treat.
Because in an American movie, the hand dryer wouldn't work.
All right.
Yeah, good. Joel Schumacher.
Well, my number two was supposed to be my number three, but I was worried Dingus was going to scoop it. So my number two, best scene in a bathroom that isn't gross. So I won't name other movies, but in a lot of movies, the restroom is where you go for a quick moment of sanctuary. Like if something's really difficult, you go in here and the actor will, you know, splash water on his face and look at himself in the mirror and steel his resolve. And it's like a sanctuary. You repair yourself in there. In this movie, that's the scene you kind of think you're looking at, but it ends up being the scene of absolution. And the character announces what he's going to do, and then he shaves, and he cuts his hair, and he does it. Did I scoop you?
You're such a jerk. I should have done this as number two. Oh, F you.
And the funny thing is, when he announces what he's going to do, he kind of breaks the rules, because the director, Wes Anderson, loved this line from, I think, a Truffaut film. So he just tells Luke Wilson to say the line, even though the timing is incorrect. And the line is, "Tomorrow I'm going to kill myself." And then he shaves and he cuts his hair and he slits his wrists right there. He doesn't wait until tomorrow. And it's to the Elliott Smith song, "Needle in the Hay." And it's just such a dramatic character moment in the Royal Tenenbaums. And it's so crucial to this idea of the bathroom as a place of sanctuary or absolution. And I just love the way it unfolds. Luke Wilson is so good in it. It's such a culmination of what this character is going through. So that's my number two, is Royal Tenenbaums.
I'm sure glad I didn't use that one.
Dingus, was that your number one?
You were the world's biggest jerk.
I almost, just a minute ago, I was like, no, I'll just do this as my number two. But I can't.
Dingus, always do your Wes Andersons as number three, because you know he's going to do it. You know the rules.
Well, I thought I was safe because of the gross rule. Because blood appears and
that's not gross.
Well, for some of us are a little queasy about blood. I'm not going to name any names.
The blood is such an artistic part of that scene. I mean, the blood running into the porcelain sink, it is so lovely, and it's not played for, like, gross factor. But you're right, I did wonder about that, Dingus. Because I can think of plenty of, like, horror movies
scenes
that have, like, gore. But I didn't think of that. I didn't think of the blood. I didn't think of it in that light.
He thought, Dingus is going to do this, so I'll make it my number two. That'll solve that.
Well, Dingus, I actually thought there's one that I didn't pick because I thought you were going to choose it. And it was a similar approach where a character goes to a restroom as a place of sanctuary to sort of gather his thoughts, but instead of killing himself, he freaks out in a very different way. And I didn't use that one. And I don't think it's Kelly Wan's number one, but I almost picked French Drunk Love.
Well, the thing is, you know, I was going to justify exactly the way you said it, how the blood is filmed. You know, in the scene directly following it, they're covered in blood. But there's a thread on three that's this movie Frame Game. And one of the incredible frames is that what you just described, Tom, is him with hair covering the sink and his hands there and the blood coming off of them. It's just gorgeous and heartbreaking. And I can't get away from how incredibly this scene is filmed and edited. There's that moment where he flashes to Mordecai, and he flashes to Margot? What's her name?
Yeah. It's my adopted daughter, Margot.
He flashes. There's these quick flashes, and he says that line that you just described. I was going to give you guys the Dudley line that comes before the scene in hopes to avoid having to say that line, but it's such an amazing line. And then that song. Needle in the Hay, I'd never heard it before this moment, and it still, whenever I hear it now, it brings me up short. I mean, it takes my breath away because of that scene.
What's the Dudley line?
What'd you say?
What's the Dudley line?
Oh, it's. You want to play some word games or do some experiments on me or anything? And what you don't see, and took me a couple of viewings to really get, is that Luke Wilson is preparing during that line. He comes in through another room. The bathroom is one of these bathrooms that has two doors that you can pass through. And he comes through while Dudley saying that line. He closes the door behind him. Dudley says that line. This is after they've found out about Margot, after the private investigator has given him his report. Given them his report,
right.
And then he shuts the other door, and then it goes into that scene. And you already hear the music playing before that, but the tone of that scene, I can't talk enough about it.
And there's Dudley's, and also then Dudley finds his body, and there's that chilling, like silent scream where Dudley, you know, yells, and you don't hear anything. If I'm not mistaken, I think the music even pauses at that point, and then
You're
picks
right.
up again when they're rolling him into the hospital.
You're absolutely right, and that is a stunning moment. It is absolutely silent, and it's a silent scream for him, and then when they're pushing the dolly, it's just, bam, the music's back on.
I mean, I think it's probably, just as far as, like, thinking where Wes Anderson has basically, like, sucked the air out of my lungs, it's either that or I Couldn't Save Mine from
right.
Darjeeling Limited.
Right.
Hmm. Another water scene.
Yeah.
See what he did there? James Cameron.
So this one is even more poignant for me because of the problems that Owen Wilson ended up having.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, this isn't Owen Wilson we're talking about, but he's intimately related to this movie, of course, and to Luke. And to see this, it's impossible for me to divorce what happened to him, who's somebody he's somebody I really care about and love, you know, as much as a fan can love a star, and to know what's going on or what had gone on with him, and to see this scene, it's really difficult and still really moving.
Yeah. All right, so my number two, Dingus is number one. You guys will never guess my number one, and I have no idea what Kelly Wan's number one is, but Kelly, you're about to tell us. What do you got for us?
Okay, I had the most iconic bathroom scene ever. But there's not much to say about it, so I'm going to pretend it's not my number one and do this as my number one.
Okay.
Okay, this movie has three bathroom scenes in it, one of which is technically a little gross. Name them.
What is the movie?
All right, I'll give you a hint. That's true. That would be a good... All right. The actual hint is it's The Shining. Name
now,
all three bathrooms.
So, see, that's certainly an iconic bathroom scene, but I don't know what the other two...
But the bathtub scene is gross. What are you talking about?
Yeah, the bathtub scene is gross, but I can't think of a third one.
Not if you're old.
And rotting.
Yeah. Well, like Wilford Brimley and Cocoon. Like, that would be a porn to him, wouldn't it?
If your skin is rotting, that is a hot scene. You're right.
What is the third one, Kelly Wand?
Wait, what's the second one?
Well, so there's Shelley Duvall shut in the bathroom and the axe.
Yeah,
breaks.
Here's Johnny's scene, right?
That's the one I thought was most famous. And then when I was talking to someone about this, she brought up the corpse where Jack Nicholson makes out with the corpse. Because I
Wait, a girl brought that up to you? That's hot.
But I don't know what the third one is.
It's the scene where he's with Grady and he's telling him... that he cut up his wife and daughters. And he's
you know, someone, so the girl I was talking to about that said that was one too, but I thought Grady being the bartender, right?
No, that's Lloyd.
Yeah. Oh, who's Grady then?
Grady's like the butler kind of guy, and he goes, a nigger cook is interfering. Remember that guy?
Wow. Like, you know what? I need to see The Shining again because I haven't seen it in forever. And I mean, I never really cared for it.
What?
It's
ridiculous.
It's just kind of awkward and stilted, and I'm not quite sure.
No, it made it tapped into our fear of steady cams.
and quick zooms onto characters' faces.
And evil little British twins.
And Scatman Crothers' art on the wall above his bed.
Yeah, come on. You don't like that? That's awesome. You're weird, man, for not liking
I need to see it again. I need to
Also, if you see it, you can hear him typing, all work and no play makes Jack a dull boy. Like, space.
I can't stand The Shining. I can't stand it.
See, Kelly Wand, you're outnumbered on this podcast. What do you think of that?
Stephen King doesn't like it.
Yeah, I'm with him.
Oh, in that case, I do like it.
Well, you know why he doesn't like it, though, Kelly.
He said it wasn't faithful enough. And it didn't blow up at the end. The hotel. Well, spoiler alert.
His specific problem, or his problem from the jump, is casting Jack Nicholson. Because Jack Nicholson had just been in One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, and so that immediately...
Crazy already starts out as crazy.
And that's not what this should be. It should be a normal guy who has some anger problems, clearly, and he's got some problems. He doesn't start the book as white as the driven snow. But the film goer shouldn't think, oh, this guy's nuts.
Let's, as a thought exercise, recast The Shining amongst ourselves. I would choose John Ritter.
I'll take Kelly Brook for Shelley Duvall.
Because you would recast Shelley Duvall? Because I kind of like how awkward she looks in
Daniel Day-Lewis.
Oh, Kelly Wand, you just shut the game down before Dingus even had a turn. Mm. Well done. Well done. Dingus, can you follow that, or are you just going to opt out? I would just opt out if I were you, Dingus.
Morgan Rich Wilson. As Danny? Oh, wait. All right.
The Shining. Good. Dingus, you're number one. Royal Tenenbaums. Good choice.
Thanks.
Predictable.
My number one. So, Dingus, there are movies about junkies. And, Dingus, you once said something very insightful about junkie movies that now makes it difficult for me to watch movies about junkies or alcoholics. And, Dingus, the way you put it is junkies are tedious. And I agree. And it's so hard watching junkie movies these days. But there's one junkie movie that I don't know if either of you has seen it that is definitely not in the junkies are tedious category. And it's about a day in the life of two heroin addicts, and it's the day they're trying to kick because somebody that they know and they love has just overdosed, and she's in the hospital recovering, and they decide, you know what, we're going clean. So this is that day. It's almost got this, like, after-hours quality where it's a contained setting, and they go around on this kind of picaresque journey. And a lot of what they have to navigate is bureaucracy. It's got a little bit of a touch of social realism to it. And it's called Gridlocked. And instead of ED, it's a Gridlock apostrophe D. It was directed by Vondi Curtis Hall. And the two junkies. Yep. Tupac Shakur and Tim Roth. So actually two of mine have Tim Roth in them as bathroom scenes. And the beauty of Gridlocked is that Tupac Shakur is really good in it. But rewatching it this past week, Tim Roth is amazing in it for a couple of reasons. One of the reasons is because he's not playing a very bright character. Tim Roth normally plays someone who is very shrewd, very observant, even when he is a little dim like that. Oh, what's that movie with John Hurt that we recently saw, Dingus? The Hitman? Was it The Hitman? It's called something like that with Terrence Stamp and John Hurt.
The Hit, right.
So he's even a little dim in that, but he's a shrewd, sharp character. In Gridlocked, he's a blunt, dull, oblivious guy, but he's so loyal to his friend. And watching when there's other action going on in the scene, watching Tim Roth in this movie is just fascinating. It's just one of those. He's so present as this different character, and he's got such chemistry with Tupac Shakur, and Tupac Shakur really anchors it. I mean, it's one of those things you watch and you're like, wow, this was I didn't know any of his music, but you're like, wow, this guy was really a performer, and there was some gravity there. So there's a scene late in Gridlocked, and I don't want to say too much about it because I don't want to spoil it, because I recommend Gridlocked. It really holds up. But near the end of the movie, there's a scene where they're hiding from cops in a bathroom, and they're each in neighboring stalls, and they have a conversation in which Tim Roth confesses something that's very, very important to the plot and to his character. And when this happens, you only see their feet. It's just a shot of the stalls and their feet under the stalls, and they have this this amazing sort of revelation, and the camera stays out there. You know, eventually it cuts in there, but when this happens, you just see their feet, and they have done such a great job establishing their character and the connection they have that you don't need to see the rest of them. And that's actually, I've just been thinking about this scene for a while, and that's what made me bring up this 3x3, is specifically because I wanted to recommend Gridlocked. So, am I right? Neither of you has seen it?
No. I don't see movies with apostrophes in the title.
I haven't.
Okay.
I haven't seen it. Vondi Curtis Hall is a... Wasn't he on ER?
He's an actor because he's in it, too, and he's very familiar looking to me. I meant to look up whether or not he's directed other stuff.
He was on ER. He was definitely on ER.
Mm-hmm.
I think he played... I can't remember how he played it. Somebody's boyfriend or husband.
I don't watch TV series with forward slashes in the titles.
You know, that I haven't seen this, but I'm really interested now because... one of the things I really liked about what you said is that it's really difficult to play somebody who's slower than you are. That's not an easy thing to do. And Tim Roth does it very well, and now I'm really interested in this.
Well, that's the thing, is where, like, I'm trying to, isn't in Rosencrantz and Guildenstern Are Dead, isn't he the sharper one and Gary Oldman is the more dull character?
I don't remember it at all.
Like, well, when has Tim Roth played, like, a dim character? Because I don't think he has that often. He's normally the super cool, super smart, hip guy, or he's like the villain in that Hulk movie.
Well, he gets pwned by Samuel Jackson in Pulp Fiction. He's dumb in that.
Oh, you know what? That's a very good point, Kelly Wan. Yep, he is. Yeah. He's like a low-life thug kind of guy. Yeah, very good point.
He's kind of dumb in The Hulk, too, because he gets his ass handed to him repeatedly and loses every fight with the stupidest superhero ever. that makes him kind of dumb, in my book.
But. All right, so runners-up. Did anyone have Godfather 2 or De Niro goes to get the gun?
That's Godfather 1.
Godfather 1, that's what I meant.
That's Pacino, also. So you got the wrong actor and the movie.
Myself, actor's name. I saw one of these Roman numerals. There, I'm all set.
You guys didn't say Psycho. I'm really surprised.
Psycho is a good one, yeah. Yeah.
Also, Poltergeist, which is kind of gross.
What's the bathroom scene?
He peels his face off.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Craig T. Nelson, yeah.
No, it's a guy who's not in the movie except for that one scene.
Really?
Yeah, oh, this guy could die because he's not even in the movie much. Huh?
Okay.
And it's so random. It's just like starts out really slow. It's good. London with Jessica Biel and Chris Evans and Jason Statham. Did you ever see that?
What is that? No, what is it?
It's set in a bathroom. That he's like a cocaine. Jessica Biel breaks up with Chris Evans, and it's like a Manhattan party, and he just spends the whole movie in the bathroom, like trying to get her back.
That's great. London? I love that.
Mears, very gross.
Amy Smart ripping her jaw open. Yeah.
Yeah. Lethal Weapon 2.
What's that bathroom scene?
The toilet's got a bomb on it, and they have to dive into the tub, and then the toilet flies out and lands on the police car hood.
Good shit. That's a good one, Kelly Wan.
Dumb and Dumber has multiple bathroom scenes that are good.
Come on, they've got to all be gross.
They've got to be gross, yes.
Fast Times at Ridgemont High.
Good one. That's a great one. The Phoebe Cates discovery of walking into the bathroom. Yeah. That's a good
Orphan.
One.
Orphan. Plot with, points.
What's the specific bathroom?
The bath. What? That's not gross. Or
I'm just worried about spoilers at this point.
Okay, all right. Get Smart on the airplane bathroom where he gets hooks put through his cheeks. That's always good.
Ouch. That sounds kind of gross, though.
Pink Panther Strikes Back, where the assassins shoot each other because he bends down to get the toilet paper. I know my bathrooms. Yeah.
But you clearly do. Good Lord.
I thought about Constantine, where he has to convince Rachel Weisz of the existence of the other world. And the line, should I take my clothes off? I'm thinking.
That's good. Dingus? Runner-up bathrooms?
I'll just name two, since there's a really good little bathroom scene in Running Scared.
The one with Gregory Hines and Billy Crystal?
Yeah, he in a prescription bottle and Vera Farmiga. Yeah.
One. I thought you were thinking of the one with the homeless guy, Dingus.
No, I'm just thinking of what's going on in their surrounding scene and what goes on in the bathroom. Right. And the other one, and the one that made that Kelly Wan made me think of when he was talking about peeing earlier, let me give you a line, Tom, and see if you can figure out which movie I'm talking about.
Okay,
ready?
Mm-hmm. Pods.
Oh, so good.
Oh,
Why didn't I think of that? Oh, that's a
4-inch chest.
No.
Wait, what is it?
Perfumes pants.
Maybe he fucks horses.
Wait, what is it?
What's your name, maybe that fuck?
Maybe he came in here and he scrolled it in a moment of drunken sincerity.
Meaning of life?
Now, Dingus and I will do a scene from you for you. Are you ready? No, actually, Dingus can do this.
I'm not good with this.
It's Whipnail and I.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Richard E. Grant, where Paul came into the bathroom after being called a ponce, and he sees graffiti, and he starts imagining that the guy who just called him a ponce is the guy who wrote the graffiti, and then is going to come in and bugger him.
I love that movie, and I never guess it right when someone does it.
Perfumed ponce!
And then after you say it's with nail, I go, oh yeah, with nail, and I see him.
That's right, because he comes out, and doesn't he have, he stepped in perfume or something, or I forget what, okay, I haven't seen that in probably a year. I need to rectify that. That movie should be seen at least once a year.
Well, I keep trying to buy it, and it's really tough to find, actually.
Oh, is it?
Well, at least the last couple of times I've looked for it on Amazon, it's been out of print or whatever.
Well, do you know, Dingus, that his name is Bruce Robinson? He hasn't done a lot of movies lately. He's got another one coming up, I think, this year. Do you know that? It's this Rum Diaries movie with, I think Johnny Depp might be in it or something.
Really?
Yeah, a new Bruce Robinson movie. About time.
Is what's his name in it?
He's my favorite. Hey, I've never been called a ponce in real life, but an old woman called me a brute one time when I came out of Starbucks.
A brute? What did you do to be called a brute?
I was standing in the door too long for her taste. But it kind of turned me on, even though she was old. But kind of like The Shining, that one's...
We have a friend named Brad who happily refers to me as Ponce quite often.
So it's like the British dunce, huh? Right? Kirsten Dunst.
No, it's more like bent.
You're a bender, wanker.
All right. Well, next week let's see a James Mangold movie. How do you guys feel about that? Come on, because we all like 3:10 to Yuma, right? Right.
Right.
So his next movie. Night and Day, yeah.
Oh, the one with Katherine Heigl and Ashton Kutcher.
Come on, Night and Day. And there's they even do a little gag with the night being a homonym for, you know.
Oh, that animated short before Toy Story 3, Night and
Oh,
Day.
I didn't even think of that. You're right, Kelly Wand, yeah. Night and Day.
Oh, wait, that Francois Truffaut movie?
Did they get the title from Robin Hood?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, that's right, because there was a night joke in Robin Hood. Yeah. But before we move on, we need a 3x3 for next week. Who's up for providing one? Kelly, do you got something?
Yeah, okay. Three movies about telekinesis set in high school. JK. There's only two, so that would be.
Wait, Firestarter and the one where the kids make the it's not a roller coaster, it's one of those like horizontal Ferris wheels, and there's a bunch of Arabs riding in it, and they use their mind to make one of the cars break loose.
Oh, yeah, the Fury.
Fury, yes. Very good.
They're not in high school, though.
Oh, they're not?
Firestarter's in elementary school.
Stop. Oh. Well, she could. She might have skipped a few grades.
Has the body of a fifth grader.
Stop.
All right, what's your real 3x3, Kelly Wand?
All right, pick A, B, or C.
What? No, you pick A, B, or C.
All right. Well, these all... All right. None of these are good.
Pick the best
one. Really? All right. Let's save these crappy ones for later? Because maybe we want to, like, roll into the good ones.
No, save the crappy ones. Because
I might come up with a good one later.
Exactly.
You're always promising a good one. So that's good.
But I want to see what the listeners come up with for the dumb ones. All right. Never mind. That's a stupid way to pick a topic. You're right. All right. Theirs are all bad, though. They're all equally bad.
Do you want relevant? Do you have one that's somehow relevant? Actually, I shouldn't have even said that. Scratch that.
Wait, what's next week? Okay, no, wait. You know what? This is relevant.
Okay.
It ties into Night and Day.
Mm-hmm.
The three least convincing screen couples ever.
I like that.
Good. Tom Cruise and Cameron Diaz are...
Stop talking.
Cool. Yeah. Are eligible. They are not. Well, you know, Tom takes movies off the table. I'm saying Night and Day is like we can. That is our number one. I have no problem with that.
All right, good. I like that. Okay. All right, so join us next week for our 3x3, the three least convincing screen couples ever. We will be spoiling Night and Day, spelled with a K for everyone. I am Tom Chick. I am joined by Christian Marduk.
Mardukas, Jonathan. Yeah, no, it's Christian Morosky, but that was close.
Close. And also Kelly Wand.
Wait, Day is a silent K? Okay, so Superman's an alien, and he's trying to stay incommunicado, so he works at a metropolitan newspaper surrounded by investigative reporters all day.